consciousness wishes to express itself through you as you, and that you are the one that you've been waiting for. Blessings. Look forward to being with you guys again next week. Mark, thanks so much, man. All right.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Take care. Peace. Bye.
This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. The previous program was Quantum Medicine with Dr. Kamau Kakai, heard Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Stay tuned for Radio Gag, Gays Against Guns, coming up.
Radio Gag, the Gays Against Guns show. Prepare to gag, yeah!
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Radio Gag, the weekly Gays Against Guns show. This show is our weekly update on how to end the horror that is the American gun violence epidemic. I'm Tricia Cook. For those of you who don't know about Gag, we're an inclusive, direct action group of LGBTQ people and their allies committed to nonviolently breaking the gun industry's chain of death. That means investors, manufacturers, the NRA, and politicians who block safer gun laws. This week's show is the first of a two-part series focusing on the continuum of violence from handguns to nuclear weapons and the gendered issues of those who perpetuate the violence. Last year, Paul Rowley and I spoke with a panel of women from the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons about the issues of gendered violence, divestment from nuclear arms, proposed legislation, and more. This week's show features Ray Atchison talking about weapons and gender. We'll also hear from Kathleen Sullivan about the resolution now before the City Council that would support the 2017 Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. But up first, Sarah Lilly will take a few minutes to acknowledge someone who has lost their life to gun violence with our In Memoriam.
Jared James Sykes of Dardanelle, Arkansas, born July 31st, 2000, died in a tragic hunting incident on January 17th, 2021. His obituary on the Cornwell Funeral Home website says, "Jared brought light and mischief into the world from the day he was born until the moment we lost him. If you knew Jared, you probably have a story to share. He could make you laugh until you cried. He was smart, handsome, kind, loving, caring, ornery, mischievous, and just downright likable. He was known for his laid-back, it'll-be-all-right attitude. He was loved immensely and mothered by many, in addition to his own mom, but he took it all in stride, often ignoring the extra input with a grin and a nod. Jared would do anything needed for family and friends, from moving furniture to having a caring, listening ear. Family and friends were important to him, and he lived that out. He was a student at Arkansas Tech University and a member of the Arkansas National Guard. He was an employee of First Bank and former employee of Burisink Furniture and Office Products. He was a member of First Baptist Russellville and attended New Life Church, Russellville. On his Facebook page about a year ago, Jared posted an idea that he had for a movie theater restaurant in Dardanelle. Over 100 people liked his idea on Facebook. Jared, we remember you.
Another life lost too soon. Thank you, Sarah. Last year, Paul Rowley and I spent some time with members of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, known as ICAN. We discussed loads of issues with them. New legislation, divestment, how gender comes into play when thinking about and using weapons, and connections between the GVP movement and the nuclear disarmament movement. Today we'll hear from Ray Atchison, who talks with us about weapons and gender.
My name is Ray Atchison, and I am the director of the disarmament program at the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. And it was founded by women who came together during World War I to protest the killing and to devise a plan to end war. I work in several activist coalitions on different weapon systems, from autonomous weapons and drones and small arms and the arms trade. And nuclear weapons, of course, is a big focus of our work. And so I represent WILC on the steering committee of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, which won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2017.
Great.
Important work.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, the reason that we think this is just such an interesting topic for the show is because there are so many similarities between the work that you folks are doing against nuclear arms and the work that we're doing in Gays Against Guns and other people in the gun violence prevention movement are doing. So, Ray, let's start with you. So what similarities do you see between the work that you've been doing and that of the gun violence prevention movement?
Whenever I start talking about these ideas around masculinity and patriarchy and the relationship to weapons, I like to clarify at the beginning that when we're talking about gender and gender norms and ideas, we're not talking about biological sex. We're not talking about the binary of being a man or being a woman, but we're talking about how society expects us to act. And this idea of what it is to be a real man and how society has expectations on us for masculinities really is the same when we're talking about nuclear weapons or whether we're talking about guns. It's this idea that weapons provide power and weapons enable people to protect and to take care of. And so this idea that weapons are for security and for safety, even though they make us all less safe, regardless of who we are or what body we are in.
Absolutely.
And this in itself instills a hierarchy of worth and value and capacity amongst humans, right? It's usually this notion that part of being a man is that you have to protect your family, protect your women, protect whomever it is that you're in charge of. But it also means then that you have power over those people. They are less than you in some way because you are delegated the person to look out for them. This idea that you need weapons in order to do that. And we can also look at how this is, in a militarized sense, really instilled in the education of soldiers, for example, in this building of the hierarchy. There's this language and framing of human beings that really denigrates women, denigrates queer people in the training of soldiers, whether it's through calling them names or just the culture of violence that is instilled in that process of building up soldiers. So that's one example of that. But I also like to mention that this concept, this militarized masculinity or this violent masculinity, this expectation that men will be violent, will take up arms in order to protect, really also makes men more vulnerable. Because it develops this assumption that in any given context, the men will be militant. We can see it in, say, drone strike targeting, in the way that the U.S. government has been revealed to target men of a military age solely on the basis of them being men, that they're viable targets in a drone strike. Or we've seen where mass atrocities have been committed during conflict, where men are rounded up and shot to prevent them from joining a military campaign. So there's also this increased vulnerability on men. So in my opinion and in thinking about this, it seems that this violent masculinity where weapons are about protection and power really undermines everyone's safety and everyone's protection.
Yeah.
So listeners to this show are going to be very familiar with, say, the NRA arguments around guns, that guns are necessary for security, right? And if you give them up, you're being weak. If you give them up, you're losing ground. And there's so much concern with the government coming to take your weapons. And there's the same narrative really around nuclear weapons, that they're necessary weapons. They're described as necessary evils, that they've prevented conflict in the world. They prevent us from being attacked by other countries, and they've preserved some sort of peace and stability in the world order. And it's in this framing that people come to believe that more weapons are the answers to threats. And so in the NRA language, you have guns are good in the right hand.
Yeah.
You need the good guy with the gun to oppose the bad guy with the gun. And again, it's the exact same narrative on nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons in the right hands are necessary, and we have to prevent the bad guys from getting them. But in the meantime, we have to hold on to ours because it's the only safety and security that we have in the world. But of course, a critical examination of that makes us ask, who are the good guys? Who gets to decide who's the good guys and the bad guys? Because everyone with these weapons is capable of massive violence. But people who raise this analysis, we're ridiculed, and we're often ridiculed in very gendered ways. We're told that we're weak. We're told that we're irrational. We're told that we don't understand how security works or how the world works. We're really naive. So much of this is said in gendered language, that ultimately what people are saying when they say all this is that we're effeminate. We're not up to the task of that violent masculinity, of that real man. And so I think one of the things that needs to be taken into account is who we're including in our conversations. Who gets to be credible when we're talking about guns or talking about nuclear weapons or talking about any kind of weapon? So we need more people. We need a lot more diversity involved in these conversations about security and weapons.
Yeah, I feel like what's happening here with guns and also with this power thing, fear is really, I think, what's driving so much of it, it seems, you know, that we don't really hear so much from the victims of this violence. You know, we hear from the defenders of the rights rather than the people who are impacted at the most. So, like, I really think this idea that, you know, what you're saying about diversifying the discussion is really key to a strategy, right?
Yes, absolutely. In ICANN's work to develop the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, we really tried to center the voices of survivors of the U.S. atomic bombings of Japan, but also survivors of nuclear weapon testing. So Indigenous Australians, folks from the Marshall Islands and other places in the Pacific where testing occurred, as opposed to centering the voices of, say, the elite from Washington, D.C. or Moscow, you know, people operating in the corridors of power who have sort of a chokehold on what is considered to be credible discourse on nuclear weapons. So we really tried to turn that narrative and that framing back over to people who have direct experience and look at these weapons for what they actually do to people in the environment. Look at the humanitarian and environmental consequences of these weapons instead of allowing this discourse around security and deterrence and necessity that has been dictated to us for so long by a select group of people within corridors of power.
Yeah, absolutely. Recognizing that consensus building is the only way to bring about real change, in the gun control movement, as in nuclear weaponry, what advice can you give us? What's helped you? What hasn't helped in reaching people and implementing change?
Well, I think that the process of consensus building is very important. But I also think we need to think carefully about when and how we're doing that. I think change is not necessarily made by having everyone on the same page at the same time. If we look at history and how change has been made, changes often come not from those who have the offending behavior, if you will. If we look at the abolition of slavery, the movement to and the change to abolish slavery didn't come from slave owners. If we look at women's right to vote, it wasn't granted by men who held all the political power. It came from the social movements of women who were campaigning for that. If we look at shifts in LGBT rights and cultural shifts around identities and sexualities, those didn't come from the people that held the powers. It came from outside, and it wasn't the process of getting those people or every single person to agree to something. It's more about shifting a majority, getting a majority tidal wave forming that can create the change. And of course, with all of these things, it's not like by abolishing slavery, we don't have racism. It's not like by having gay marriage in this country, we don't have discrimination against the LGBT community. Obviously, all of these things still exist. Obviously, there's pushback for every piece of ground that we make in social movement history. But we do make these shifts, and it comes from relentless activism. The lesson from negotiating the treaty on the prohibition for nuclear weapons, for example, we worked for 70 years to try and get nuclear armed states to eliminate their nuclear weapons. That was our main focus, is demanding that they get rid of their nuclear weapons. And that is still the demand. But what we did with this treaty to help make this shift is we worked with the non-nuclear armed states, the countries that have rejected the idea that nuclear weapons provide any kind of security. And as activist coalition, we worked with those governments to bring about a change in narrative towards the humanitarian consequences, the environmental consequences, and away from this security deterrence discourse. And we worked with those countries to embolden them to feel that they had a credible stake in this issue and that they could actually do something. They could help create new international law on nuclear weapons that helped stigmatize these weapons, prohibited these weapons under international law, and that helps change the framing in the general perception of what nuclear weapons are. And so I think that is a very important lesson for the gun control debates. You know, as things stand right now, there is a lot of money and a lot of power on the side of those who want to hold on to guns and continue to see this country armed to the teeth. And I feel that there is momentum right now that is critically shifting what is normal, what is considered acceptable behavior. And we're in the midst of that shift right now, and it's a very exciting time to be in. And I think that is where the energy needs to go. It's not necessarily on convincing everyone in the NRA that this approach is right, but it's shifting what is normative and the majority opinion on this issue.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. It's like, so you're talking about empowering individual voices through which we empower communities. These communities lead to coalitions, and then you get to the point where you folks have reached where you're doing this on a national level, which is, you know, really the
international level.
International level, yeah. Wonderful.
A big thank you to Roy Acheson for taking the time to speak with us. You can hear the second part of our conversation about guns and nuclear weapons later this month. You're listening to Radio Gag, the Gays Against Guns show, here on listener-sponsored commercial-free radio WBAI 99.5. We are here every Tuesday afternoon at 2:30 p.m. bringing you the latest from the gun violence prevention movement. Gays Against Guns is urging our listeners to keep free speech radio alive by sending a tax-deductible donation to WBAI 99.5 FM. You can also become a Radio Gag BAI buddy by visiting WBAI.org. Next up, I spoke with Kathleen Sullivan this weekend about her work with NICAN, the New York City-based partner of ICAN, and the legislation they're trying to get passed by the City Council. I'm here today talking with Kathleen Sullivan about legislation that NICAN has been working on and what the future looks like for it. So, Kathleen, if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and your affiliation with NICAN and talk about the legislation.
Thank you so much, Tricia. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to this. So I work with NICAN, the New York Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, and we are a group of affiliated groups that work with the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. We're all based here in New York City. We've been working on a campaign with Danny Drom, council member from Jackson Heights, Queens. And this legislation work started in around 2018. And from that, we have two very, very progressive pieces of disarmament legislation, Resolution 976 and Intro Bill 1621. a lot of people don't realize that nuclear weapons actually started in New York City. They did not call it the Manhattan Project for nothing. One thing that few people will realize is that New York City is invested in around $500 million worth of money in our pension funds, which is a fraction of the New York City pension. That's about 0.025% of the pension funds. Wow. Are invested in companies that produce nuclear weapons. So we would like for that to be divested from New York City pension funds. That's part of Resolution 976. So that's a very direct way that New York City is still connected to nuclear weapons. Also, what few people will recognize is that around two-thirds of the uranium that was used in the top-secret Manhattan Project was stored in and around the five boroughs. So we still have some places that may need environmental remediation. Mm-hmm. I'm speaking to you from Chelsea, where as late as the early 90s, there was still residual uranium that was needed to be cleaned up in the Baker and Williams warehouses. And those warehouses remained in use for over 40 years, even though their radiation levels were 38 times the federally allowed levels. The mm-hmm. Intro Bill 1621 establishes a nuclear weapon-free zone advisory committee, which could advise city council on such projects as the environmental remediation that may need to be done for these legacy sites.
Right, right. And can you talk about where this legislation stands right now?
So we had a very successful council hearing in January of 2020, but our campaign really laid off doing any work when the pandemic was so up in front of everybody, mm-hmm. particularly our champion on this, Danny Drom, whose constituents include Elmhurst, which was at one point the hardest hit place in the entire country. But once city council started to go back to sort of regular business, we then started pushing again, because we really feel that this legislation is part and parcel to why spend on militarism when we aren't spending on healthcare. We want the city of New York to be a model for redirecting funds towards human needs. Mm-hmm. So we have a super majority, and that means that as soon as we get this legislation to the floor for a vote, it should pass without incidents. And as far as we know right now, the only reason that this has not been brought to the floor for a vote is, unfortunately, it's not been on a high priority list for Council Speaker Corey Johnson. But we're continuing to work very hard and continuing on our campaign to educate the public.
Mm-hmm. So, Kathleen, can you speak to what our listeners might be able to do? Should people be making phone calls? Should they be sending emails?
Well, the best thing to do is to call your council member and ask them to ask for the council speaker, Corey Johnson, to bring Resolution 976 and Intro Bill 1621 to the floor for a vote. And we have created a toolkit for the legislation that you can find on the Rise and Resist website under the action section of the uh-huh. website. And you can also find it on the Hibakusha Stories website, Hibakusha Stories, hibakushastories.org, right at the front of our website.
That's all such great work, Kathleen. Thank you so much for your work on this legislation and with NICAN. And thanks for speaking with us today.
Well, and I'd like to say thanks to Rise and Resist and Gays Against Guns, and the crossover that we've had through this legislation has been really exceptional. And so I just give a shout out to the activist community here in New York City. So thank you, Tricia.
Gays Against Guns wants to thank WBAI for helping us reduce gun violence through our show, Radio Gag. WBAI has been supporting free speech and progressive issues for more than 60 years. Whether it's racial justice, gay rights, women's rights, climate justice, international or immigration rights, WBAI has been breaking new ground in reporting. Without your financial support, we would lose this legacy. You can do your part to take action by giving a donation to WBAI today. Go to give2wbai.org or call 516-620-6302. That's give, the number 2, wbai.org. Thank you. To find out more about becoming a member of GAG, please go to gazeagainstguns.net or follow us at Gaze Against Guns New York on Facebook and Instagram, and GAG No Guns on Twitter. For more information about how to attend member meetings, check us out on our social media platforms. Our next meeting is Thursday, March 4th at 7 o'clock. That's this Thursday. We leave you with our fabulous singing quartet, Sing Out Louise.
God help America. What have you done? Stand beside us and guide us through the mess and distress you've begun. With your bigots and your gun nuts, every greedy billionaire. God help America through this nightmare. Come on, America, stand up to hate. Don't divide us, unite us. You can break us to make us more great. Tell the bigots and the gun nuts, every greedy billionaire. Let's make America more free and fair. God help America through this
WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York. I'm Amara Emring with some brief news headlines. Yesterday, the U.S. reported over 58,000 new cases of coronavirus and over 1,500 deaths. Over 306,000 new cases were counted worldwide yesterday, along with over 7,200 additional deaths. As the number of new global infections rose last week for the first time in nearly 2 months, a World Health Organization official warned it would be, quote, premature and, quote, unrealistic to believe the pandemic would be over by the end of this year. WHO Executive Director of Emergency Services, Dr. Michael Ryan, said the virus is still, quote, in control, even while vaccinations help save lives of the most vulnerable. Ryan said that we could accelerate towards controlling this pandemic if vaccinations impact not only deaths and hospitalizations, but also transmission rates. In a deal brokered by the White House, pharmaceutical giant Merck has agreed to help manufacture the coronavirus vaccine of its competitor, Johnson & Johnson. Merck unsuccessfully attempted to create its own coronavirus vaccine. The new single-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine began shipping out Monday morning after the FDA issued emergency use authorization for the shot. It is the third COVID-19 vaccine to become available in the United States. Advisors to the CDC strongly approve the vaccine's effectiveness in completely protecting against hospitalization and death. Unlike the two other authorized vaccines made by Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine does not need to be kept frozen or followed up with a second shot. President Joe Biden has spoken up in the historic battle between Amazon and workers in Alabama, urging management to let workers decide in a video message.
I've long said America wasn't built by Wall Street. It was built by the middle class, and unions built the middle class. Unions put power in the hands of workers. They level the playing field. They give you a stronger voice for your health, your safety, higher wages, protections from racial discrimination and sexual harassment. Unions lift up workers, both union and non-union, and especially black and brown workers. I've made it clear when I was running that my administration's policy would be to support unions organizing and the right to collectively bargain. I'm keeping that promise.
The 5,800 warehouse workers in Bessemer, Alabama, began voting by mail on Friday, February 8th, with ballots due at the end of the month. Union leaders are accusing Amazon of, quote, union busting tactics, like posting anti-